Hello, and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. This week, Emmy Award-winning journalist Mary Ann Ahern talks about covering religion, writing about Chicago's Pope, and shaping the public's perception and practice of faith. Ahern is interviewed by AWM President Carrie Cranston. This conversation originally took place January 22nd, 2026, and was recorded live at the American Writers Museum. This episode is presented in conjunction with the American Writers Museum's new special exhibit, American Prophets, Writers, Religion, and Culture. This exhibit and our programming series explores the profound ways writing reflects and influences our understanding of religion. American Prophets is now open. We hope you enjoy entering the mind of a writer.
Welcome, everyone, to this program at the American Writers Museum. I'm Allison Sansoni. I'm the program director here. Thank you all for being here and for valuing the past, present, and future of American writing. Tonight's program is offered in conjunction with our newest exhibit, American Prophets, Writers, Religion, and Culture, which looks at the ways in which religion and spirituality have affected American writers' work and how that work has in turn affected the practice and perception of religion in this country. Journalist Mary Ann Ahern's career has ranged far beyond religion reporting, though that was her most high-profile assignment of late, covering the announcement of America and Chicago's first pope. She also reported from Rome on the selection of Pope Francis, Pope Benedict's farewell, and the 2014 canonization of two other pontiffs. Over the years, she covered Pope John Paul II's many trips, including Cuba and several World Youth Day events. She followed Cardinal Joseph Bernardin's final years, the selection of both Cardinal Blaise Supich and Cardinal Francis George, the beatification of Mother Teresa, and the Pope's emergency meeting with the American cardinals on the pre-sexual abuse crisis. In her storied career, Ahern has also covered political campaigns from the White House to Springfield to Chicago. She witnessed the transitions from Mayor Richard Daley to Mayor Rahm Emanuel to Mayor Lori Lightfoot to Mayor Brandon Johnson and traveled through the primary states for the 2008, 2012, 2016 presidential campaigns, just as she did in 1988 while a reporter in Atlanta. She's covered presidential election nights from Texas, Boston, New York, and Chicago, and has covered presidential inaugurations from Washington, D.C. She'll be interviewed tonight by AWM President Carrie Cranston, but before I bring them out to speak, here's a short video to introduce tonight's program.
Many people might not know this. Before I was a reporter, I was an English teacher, just like my mom. Growing up, we read all of the Chicago newspapers, the TV news, it was always on, and we were just plugged in to everything that was happening around us. And that passion for understanding the world, it led me to journalism. Today, with so much news coming out of Chicago City Hall and in Washington, my job is to cover it fairly and help you make sense of it all.
Ahern knows politics, so you know politics.
Who is Pope Leo? I'm Marianne Ahern with an inside look into Pope Leo's childhood in Chicago and how he looks to lead the world's Catholics into a new era. Southside to the Sistine, tomorrow at 7 on NBC5.
Pope Leo's first 100 days. NBC5's Marianne Ahern sits down with the Pope's brother in the suburbs for a look at Leo's journey from the South Side to the Vatican.
This is quite a burden on his shoulders.
Tonight at 6.
Thanks, everybody, for being here. Thank you, Marianne, for joining us. So, welcome, everyone. And I'm going to start off by responding to what I saw in that video at the beginning, which is you were an English teacher,
Yeah. Which
I did not know until I watched that video. So I'm very curious what, you know, led you to follow in your mom's footsteps, what led you from that to journalism, and how did those early studies and career track influence you as a journalist?
Oh, for sure. Well, thank you, first of all, to be here tonight on this freezing cold night. Thank you, thank you, thank you. That's so nice of you all to come out. I thought there'd be like three people, actually. So, and there's more watching, so thanks to those watching as well. So yes, I grew up in Michigan City, Indiana, but Chicago, you know, even though we felt like a suburb, We took the South Shore in. I think that I did more things. My mother was more about making sure that we came and did the plays and the museums than I did with my own children, and I lived right here. But So I always had an interest in journalism. I was the editor of my high school paper, and I wrote a bit in college for the college paper. I went to John Carroll University in Cleveland. But I think I was a little too shy to, can you imagine that? But not enough courage to go after this job as a 21, 22-year-old. So I did teach for 5 years. I taught at two different high schools in Chicago. I taught at Gordon Tech, and then I taught at New Trier. When it was East and West, I was at New Trier East. And so you can imagine when I walked in, and so after 5 years, and I really still had this yearning and wanted to go after my dream, I had applied to Medill, I applied to Northwestern in the fall and was accepted and didn't tell a soul until I absolutely had to, and walked in and told the principal at New Trier that I was leaving. No one left New Trier. And so I walked in and said, and I said, I'm going back to school. And he said, oh, you're going to law school? I said, absolutely not going to law school. No. I'm doing something even, no. I just said, I'm going to journalism school. And he said, oh dear, do you really think you're going to get a job? He said, have you seen those names at the end that they play on Fridays? I mean, do you really think you're going to, I said, I can do that. I think I can do that. I really do. So off I went to Medill to get my master's for a year. And you spend the last quarter, they're in the quarter system, in D.C., in Washington, D.C., as a reporter for a small station. And that gives you a video in the old days, now it's all on your phone, but literally one of those big old cassettes. And my station was Madison, Wisconsin. And so I did stories in D.C. for Madison. Senator Proxmire and his Golden Awards, Golden Fleece Awards, or whatever you call it, yes. And it was a bit unrealistic because you would call the senator's office or the congressman's office, and you'd say, and they knew the new Medill person was arriving, and they'd say, sure, come on over, and it doesn't really happen like that so much, all the time. But it gave you your video that you needed to go show to your first job to get a job. And so my dear mother, who was the English teacher and raised seven kids basically alone, broke out in shingles thinking that I was, had lost my mind and I'd left New Trier to go chase this crazy dream. And I was back home at the kitchen table typing the resumes on a typewriter, much like this. And luckily, off I went to Peoria for 2.5 years as the weekend anchor and reporter. And it really, not to dismiss Peoria, I'm really glad to get out of there, but it was a great place to have started and made my mistakes and all those things. And from Peoria, I went to Atlanta. And I really wanted to pick a place where I knew someone. It was tough. The weekends, the holidays, all of that was hard. And so I wanted to be somewhere that when it was Thanksgiving and I was working, I could still, they'd have a plate for me somewhere. And so I was searching for cities that would have, I knew someone. And my older sister was there, and I was 4.5 years in Atlanta. So, but the whole time trying to get back to Chicago, I love Chicago. And my other key was Tim Russert, if you remember Tim Russert.
Yeah.
He went to John Carroll. He was a dear friend of my brother's, one of my older brothers. He was my closer when I went to Atlanta and when I came to Chicago. They would say, the process, it takes a bit. It isn't just a 2 week, several months of them talking. It got down to the end and they would say, oh, we're going to make a decision soon. And then I would call in Tim Russert as the closer. And he really, that was great. I mean, he would call and say, he would vouch for me and didn't really know me that well, but say, hey, she's an okay person kind of thing. And he helped me many times after that as well. I would see him in the political beat, off at the elections and in Iowa and that kind of thing. But I was not, my long story is I wasn't back in Chicago a week. That my phone at my desk, and we were at the Merchandise Mart for a very short time when I came back. That's how long I've been here. And on the phone was Ralph McGee, the principal of New Trier, who said, I always knew you'd make it.
Love it.
And I said, Ralph, I recall something else. That's not what you told me. That's not what you told me. But yeah, so that's my long story of how I got here.
Okay. And so on that writing track, you know, kind of the English teacher, the studying that topic, and now you're writing the news. Talk to us a little bit before we get into a more specific topic about what it means to write for television news. What is that process like for you now? What was it like then? How much of it is collaborative with your producer? You know, what are you sitting down and typing? And what are you doing in collaboration and in the editing suite and that kind of thing?
You know, and it has changed so much. The big difference, of course, when you're an English major and you're writing essays, it's completely different when you're writing a news story. And television news, you want to hopefully have someone take away two or three facts from your story. You are not the New York Times. We are not the New York Times. Let's be factual. We're not the Chicago Tribune that can go, you know, oodles and oodles of time. But we also want to make sure that people don't watch our story and say, what was that about? You know, we want to be able to have them know, I was at City Hall today, or I was at the Archdiocese today, and this is what happened. And that's always kind of in my head of, okay, if I'm telling my sister, if I'm telling my kids, what do they want to know? They want to know what happened. They weren't following it. I was at a 5-hour city council meeting yesterday. You don't want to know the whole boring day. You just want to know what decisions were made. And was there any conflict perhaps in those decisions? Or was there all agreement? I mean, what was the mood of the room? Give them a feeling that they were there. And so it is it's a far different style. It's much more conversational. And yes, it is so collaborative. I often say it's like dominoes lined up. When one of the dominoes isn't there, the whole thing kind of, you know, and we who have just, NBC has, we've just moved to this sparkling new space. That's really cool. If you ever could get a chance to come see it. And we meet in the morning. We talk about our stories. We then discuss it with the person who is the producer of that, if you're in the 4 o'clock or if you're in the 5 o'clock. You also talk about it with your executive producer. You tell them who you're going to talk to. You come back from the story and you check in and say, here's what I've got. They say, hey, I was thinking about setting you up like this. You know, Trump's first year in office. I'm going to first of all mention, here's what he said in his speech. Then we'll go to you and you talk about what happened to Illinois? How did it impact Illinois? And, you know, we live in such a democratic tunnel. Those stories can be tough because we're also trying to make sure every voice, maybe not every voice, because that's a wonderful idea, but at least a couple voices are heard. And so even though some would rather not hear those other voices, we do our best to make sure that we bring in several sides of the story. So, yeah, it is not just, you know, even though it takes, I start work every day at 9 or 8:30, get there and have the meeting, and the story's not on till 5, you're not sitting around with your feet up. You know, you are on the phone, you're going to an event, you're coming back, you're checking in and talking to them. You might now be doing something for social media. You're going to tape something on your phone that's going to be put on Instagram or TikTok. You're also then going to write a longer version of your TV story for our website. So by the end of the day, you kind of go home like, okay. And someone will ask you, what'd you do yesterday? I'm like, remind me, you know, remind me, because it is a bit of a whirl, but I absolutely love it. Absolutely love it.
And so, you know, we're here tonight partly because we have this new exhibit that I was showing you about the intersection of religion and writing, American Prophets. So one of the reasons we wanted to talk is back in the day, TV stations, newspapers would have a beat reporter who covered religion. Mm-hmm. And that has changed. And so I'm kind of curious how and when you saw that change happening and how religion at some aspect has become a beat for you, even though you may be seen more as a political reporter. And what was the movement behind that?
Yeah, we hadn't had a Pope conclave in a dozen years, 13 years. So I literally, when the Pope Francis was sick last year, I was on vacation. I came back. I left vacation after about 3 days because I couldn't take it. I said, oh my goodness, they don't realize what a story this is, you know, and that we, Chicago, we're going to play a role in this, not knowing even who, Robert Prevost was at that point. But I just knew that Cardinal Supich and that Chicago has played such a role in the church that I did not want to miss out. You know, new people are at the station in charge. They weren't around when I did all this stuff 25, 30 years ago. I was like, whoa, I got to explain to them in person. You know, I got to tell them what this is going to, what's going to happen here. You know, it all started as a new reporter. You are a general assignment and you get sent to weather, dating tips, the newest restaurant, you know, whatever, the fire, the awful, you know, the good, the bad, the ugly. And I had been the political reporter in Atlanta. And so I really do love politics as well. But I wanted more of a niche. I wanted, you know, stories that really kind of made a difference, that people that were thoughtful. And I met with some old friends of mine who were former priests who had left to get married. And I said, I really want to do a story about you. Now, this is back in 1990. This is a couple of you weren't even born yet, you know, and I said, oh my gosh, you guys, we should do this story. You know, I think the church, you know, people just don't realize that the number of priests, and this is, you know, 35 years ago, even then there were still a lot of priests. And now we've seen how many, how much smaller the ranks have gotten. But they said to me, we're not the story. We are not the story. The story is that unfortunately there is abuse going on and there is sort of this silent effort to move them to another parish. And they're not telling the parishioners what's going on. They're just moving one guy to another place. And of course I sat there and I'm like, how could that be? You know, here I am, someone who had gone to Catholic schools. I said, that really, wait a minute. And I said, no, it really is going on. So they put me in touch with a woman who had written a story about her own son. And she had changed the names so that people would not know him. And she told the story of how, what had happened to her son as an altar boy who went off on a weekend outing with the priest and what had happened on the outing. And how then what she did, how she fought with the Chicago Archdiocese to have that priest removed. He was still at a parish. He was still at a parish in Berwyn. And he literally, he went sort of down the socioeconomic ladder. You know, he had been in Lake Forest. He had been in Arlington Heights. He had been in Des Plaines. He ended up in Berwyn. He was one of the very first priests, Robert Mayer, who did go to jail in the end. He did. But through meeting her and through then, you know, you meet one person, you meet another person, and you start to do these stories. And, you know, they were very disturbing. And it was really tough to hear it. And it was tough because the Archdiocese was not talking, you know, not, they didn't know how to handle it either and didn't know what to do. And so, you know, young report, I was all in, you know, I was calling, I was, you know, not letting up. I was all over it. And so we did in November of 1990, three-part sweep story, you know, during the time period where they monitor the ratings. One on priests who did leave to get married, one on priests who were gay, and one on priests who were abusing kids. Those stories still hold up. I mean, I've watched them again, and I think, wow, that's just amazing that we did that 35 years ago. But it's also mind-boggling all that's happened since. But those stories, they stood, the priest in my home parish in Michigan City, stood up during the sermon and said, there are lies being told at Channel 5. There are lies. My poor mother, who at first was so pleased, you know, and couldn't wait for someone to ask her at the grocery store, is that your daughter? You know, now I was like, not sure, you know, she didn't want to say too much. But anyway, the TV stories, you know, and also the Sun-Times, the two of us, it really caused the Archdiocese. This is before Boston. Boston was 2002. This is 1992, 93. And I'm telling you, every week there was another story. It was sort of like, I didn't really ask for this. But at the same time, you couldn't turn away either. You couldn't say, well, your abuse story doesn't mean as much, sorry. Oh, we did that last week. We can't do that one today. You know, so it just, it gave others the courage to speak up. And sure enough, if you would do a story, there would be more, you know, more, but there were more people about that particular priest. It wasn't, he didn't abuse one person. It was always more that would speak. Then, if you remember, Cardinal Bernardine, of course, who decided to open the books before anybody did and have a lay review board take a look at what was going on. None of the other bishops, the cardinals, nobody did that, but he did. And then he was accused. He was wrongly accused. Oh my goodness. It was, you know, it was really like my head was on a swivel all the time. That was a very difficult time. But if you also remember how he handled it, he took question after question. He really set the example of what to do when bad press comes your door. Don't close the door and say, I'm not talking about that. After about 3 or 4 days, I kept saying, guys, we've already asked him 5 times the same question. And he keeps telling us, this is not true. I don't know how many times we can follow him around and ask him that. And sure enough, it took a couple of months. But the accuser then finally said, what had happened was, the accuser, there was someone he was abused by. He felt that Bernardine looked the other way and was a part of it because he was his boss. He was the supervisor of that priest. But that was very hard on him, obviously. And, you know, to have to face that and to have to live with that. And it makes me cry almost that there weren't many people that would talk to us during this, you know, to give us sort of the expert, outside expert. There was Father Andy Greeley, and a lot of people didn't really, and not everybody liked him, but we liked him because he would talk to us. But others would be like, oh man, he never saw a microphone, he didn't like, you know, all that kind of thing. But we were glad that someone would speak up. And there was another writer named Tim Unsworth, who wrote for the National Catholic Reporter. And he was just a great guy. And he was a former brother who had left to marry. And so he would give context. So Cardinal Bernardine would go to his home, once his apartment on Belmont in Lakeshore Drive, once a year for dinner. And once he invited me to join them. I mean, it was really spectacular. Colonel Bernardine shows up and just, you know, no collar, no extra, you know, just, button-up shirt and Levi's, whatever. And I wished I had had a microphone to hear all that he talked about, because he was super kind to me when I was a bit of a pain in the neck. And he totally said, I knew where you were coming from. You had a job to do. And was very much, you know, not just me, but the stories did help the church get into a better place. But so by doing those negative stories, I had to go in at times and fight to do a positive one too. So Pope John Paul II did World Youth Days all across. Now, I didn't travel near and far, but I would Denver, Toronto. He went to Cuba. So those were really interesting. And I would go and, you know, at times you have to fight for a story and say, we need to spend the money on this. We've got to be there. And they would say, really? The Pope World Youth Day? And I'd say, yeah, because I'm the gal at every church doing the story about the bad priest. And I need to also be doing the story about the good stuff that's going on, because they think that all I'm trying to do is take people down. And that's not my goal. So by doing those stories, it really, you know, gave bigger context to what was going on in the church. And it also gave me some fabulous trips, you know, like, oh my God. I have to say, you know, getting to go to Rome several times was pretty darn cool. Yeah.
Well, I'm kind of curious, you know, based on that, I mean, in all this time, you know, from the beginning and then Bernardine, how many, you know, archbishops, cardinals in Chicago have you dealt with over the years, and how have they differed?
Oh, gosh, big time. You know, so Bernardine to George to Supich, right? Am I counting them right? I think so. You know, well, Cardinal Bernardine, you know, really, I think has everyone's heart. And he was someone that was such a part of the fabric of the city. Mm-hmm. You know, if there was a conflict, oh, he would have been on this immigration stuff. He would have been right out there. He would have been at Broadview protesting with them. Or he would have called a meeting and said, let's sit down, we've got to talk. I mean, he was really special in that regard. Oh, one other crazy coincidence. When I was in Atlanta as a reporter, I covered the Pope on his trip to the South, and he went to Columbia, South Carolina, which isn't a real big Catholic place. And we were trying to figure out, why is the Pope, and this is 1987, why is he in Columbia, South Carolina? Well, it was Cardinal Bernardine's hometown. So I found out where his sister lived, Elaine Addison, and I went, knocked on her door and said, hey, you know, the Pope's coming to your town. Isn't that pretty cool? And she's like, yeah. I said, well, we'd love to talk to you about it. And she said, you're not gonna, I said, oh, just, you know, about, and really, we just want to know how proud she was. So I had that interview. So the Pope comes to South Carolina, and they line us all up in a stadium for his mass. And we're sort of, you know, level two of the place, so that behind us, you see the whole scene. But we're all, you know, if I leaned over this way, I could have been on Chicago TV, because Paul Hogan, former reporter, Paul Hogan was right here. And someone over here was probably from LA or New York or whatever. So I see him, and of course I know him. And I say, hey, I've got an interview you want. I have an interview with Cardinal Bernardine's sister. I'll give it to you if you will give my resume tape to your boss. I was one that he was great. He did. And another one was Carol Marine, who now is, you know, one of my besties. I met her in the 1988 campaign at an airport at the debate where Lloyd Benson said to Dan Quayle, you're no John Kennedy. Yeah. And so I saw her at the airport and did the same thing. You know, I didn't have a tape to give her, but I went up and said, hey, you know, if I send you my tape, you know, will you take it? Will you walk it in? And so one day, you know, it took about 6 months later, the news director at the time called and said, I've got two people here that tell me about you. And I was like, yes, finally. Yeah. So where was I? But oh,
well, I was just saying, you know, you've dealt with all these different. You know,
oh, so different. So right, Bernardine, yeah. The social, you know, work, the leader, the someone who really tried to bring both sides together, you know, and then his own suffering. How many of you, The Gift of Peace, that book that he wrote, you know, so many give that to people when they're going through a tough time or an illness. When he walked into a newsroom or a setting at the Archdiocese, much like this, with people, all the reporters sitting, and he came to tell us that his cancer was back. And this is after, you know, these accusations that were false and the whole thing. And here it was, I can tell you, he was probably 96 or 7, I think. Anyway, I think I raised my hand and I said, Cardinal, I just am wondering why you feel like you have to tell us this. And I was sat there with my finger in my eye from, I got crying. And he said, you are my family. You're my family. Of course I'm gonna tell you. And I thought, wow, you know, those are just some of those moments. So from Bernardine to George, you know what? I liked George, but he was completely different. He was very black and white. You knew where he stood. There was no wiggle room. You know, the church is the rules are the rules. You know, there's no, none of that. But I don't care. I think that's a good something to people that are wishy-washy, whatever. You knew where you stood with him. And he would argue. He would, your questions, he would say, that's not a really great question. You might want to change, but you know what? Rahm Emanuel's like that too. But anyway, and now Cardinal Supich, we've come to a better place. But he, obviously, when you first come to Chicago and everybody's in your face, he was a little like this, you know, give me some time to figure this out. Spokane to Chicago is kind of a big leap. But now he is a huge player in the church. He really, really is. And has a very good team of people. And knowing that, that was how I went in and argued and said, we must be in Rome. I didn't know who was going to be the Pope. And I had just found out who Prevost was about 3 weeks before we went. But I said, Supich is going to play a role. And he did. He did. And he still does today. Yeah.
Yeah. And when you're on this topic and you're covering, and I think you've touched on it a little bit when you were talking about trying to cover some positive stories and some negative stories, you know, what are the biggest challenges to covering religion as a topic when you know that people are either going to react positively because the story is positive and they're positive about that topic, or they're going to be very negative because they feel you're attacking or that you're overrepresenting and being too nice to a given group? You know, are the reactions that you get stronger from people in reacting to your coverage of religious topics maybe than sometimes political or other?
Oh, very much. But I think, you know, when the Pope was named, and that was just such an unbelievable moment, that after all those years of covering the difficult story or the conflict and them not talking to me and, you know, all of that, that to have the guy from Chicago, it was just like, oh my goodness, I couldn't contain my joy I'm not usually rah-rah of every story I do, but come on, you know, 2,000 years and we've got a guy who's from Chicago, you know, you could hardly just stand there and say, and today there was someone elected, you know, it just oodled out of me. I couldn't help it. But yes, when we did the priest abuse stories, and when the political and religious beat, you know what, they somewhat, you know, they don't want to talk to you. And then guess what? When they leave office, who do they call? You know, Rahm Emanuel hated me. Now he's my bestie. Lori Lightfoot once called and said she was going to have my pension. She texts me. You know, I mean, it's, you know, the same with the church. The gal who was the head of the PR office, you know, wouldn't answer my calls. And now she sends me tidbits. You know, I mean, it's sort of like, okay. So if you don't, there, you're not to be besties as a reporter with any of them. That's not my job. You're to be respectful, and hopefully that is a two-way street. But yes, I'm human. That's hard. When you do a difficult story and you know that people aren't going to really like it, but that is, the facts are out there. You can't, that's why I think the abuse was for so long not told. A, no one could believe it at first. No one wanted to tell the story. It was just so hard to tell. And yet, once it was told, it did lead to change. There are still incidents, and it's not the Catholic Church, of course, is not the only place where that's happening. But it was rampant. It was more than 50-some priests over a 20-year period. I mean, were they drawn to the church because of, I mean, there was just so many questions about what was going on in the seminary. I mean, it just led from one story to another story. So to now be kind of on the upswing of doing some more positive story, not that I will do whatever story comes out there, but yes, it is, of course, it's wonderful to be able to talk about the Pope and what he's doing and how people are so pleased. And you know, there's going to be stuff come his way that he'll face a challenge, and hopefully we'll cover that with eyes wide open.
And so, you know, when you've been covering this topic, obviously we've been talking a lot specifically of the Catholic coverage. Has this led to you covering other religious topics because you picked that up, or have you primarily?
I know. I feel like, you know, my nickname in the newsroom is Mother Superior. First, I was just Sister Marianne, and then they elevated me. The age thing, I guess. Yeah. But, you know, the Catholic Church was always, and it still is today, but I think more when I first started covering this, was such an integral part of Chicago. The mayor was Catholic. The state's attorney was Catholic. You know, I mean, everybody went to the Catholic schools. I mean, it was, and it still is in terms of social services. In this whole immigration conflict, it was the Catholic Church who stepped up and the volunteers who stepped up to help with where are we going to house the migrants and how even what's gone on as far as peaceful protests. So, yes, I mean, it's been a natural progression to cover the Catholic Church. Should I cover more? Yes, other religions. I have it here and there. Not as much. I'd be, you know, lying if I said I didn't. But no, I have done some other stories. Of course, there's this on the South Side. We have Reverend James Meeks. We have Corey Brooks. We have Jesse Jackson. I mean, come on, you know, there is someone who has intersected the most of politics and religion. So, but yes, I've been kind of the Catholic gal.
Yeah, and I think, yeah, that was kind of my sidebar to this was the notion of the connection between covering religion and covering politics and what are the intersections there. In a city like Chicago, it's pretty vague. I'm kind of curious, you know, how often you felt like it was both.
Oh, yeah. The topic that my mother once told me, don't talk to strangers of people you don't know about politics and religion, just, you know, and then those are my, you know, my go-tos. But yes, they're very much, I mean, you have to be on top of what's going on. You often have to ask a question that might make someone uncomfortable. So you have to, you want to ask it in a respectful, but as also, I think of this often. Now I live downtown on a high rise and I walk out and nearly every day, the doorman says to me, give him hell. I'm not quite sure who the M is, you know, whoever, you know, like whether it's the mayor or the people, you know, give him hell. And I think that people sort of feel we have this really awesome job, an awesome opportunity to be in front of the mayor and the governor and the whomever every day. So if I'm just going to say, hi, are you having a nice day today? No, come on. You know, that's what we're there for. And you don't have to be difficult about it every day, but you need to ask them questions that are meaningful, that others want to know the answers to. And sometimes that can be tricky, you know, and sometimes they might not, they're calling me up after, their PR people are calling me up after and saying, that isn't true. No. You know, how did you happen to do that? Oh, for instance, today, the governor, we find out, and I didn't know this, and perhaps others did, the Tribune had it yesterday, that on this whole Bears stadium, he's had a private attorney that the state has paid for the last year and a half to the tune of $100,000, the taxpayers, you and I are paying for, to negotiate the contract that he, for a year and a half, has been saying, the Bears, I don't care about the Bears, who's going to have a state, you know, blah, blah. But now that the Bears are doing well and that Indiana wants the Bears, woo, now we find out. And having a private attorney is not necessarily odd. You know, they go to experts. The city does it too, and other places do it. I mean, they hire, you go find the expert on stadiums. Well, the guy they hired has helped put two stadiums together in Denver and in North Carolina. Seems pretty smart, actually. You know, get the guy who put stadiums together to help you figure out what do we need to get from the team and all that. But it's just sort of an inside kind of nugget that he didn't really come out and tell us about till just this last week. And so then his PR, you should see the long, like one page on, oh, this is nothing new. We do this all the time. We're looking out for the taxpayer, you know, blah, blah, blah. Sure. Yeah, whatever. But you know, you also need to come clean and say, we're all paying for this. And don't act like you're not interested in the Bears when actually behind the scenes you are. So that kind of thing goes on a lot. Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm kind of curious, you know, you brought it up a little bit, but how your own faith, what you grew up in and what you live with, influences you as a journalist, as a writer, you know, in this coverage specifically and in other coverage as well. I mean, obviously you've come from that background. So what does it do to you when you're covering it?
Yeah. I mean, I was a young gal in Michigan City, Indiana, when the first Pope, was it Pope Pius? No, Pope Paul VI, who visited New York Shea Stadium. We had to kneel in the living room and watched it on the TV. You know, my mother was like, everybody get down. You know, like, oh, the mass is on. Yeah. The day that the lawsuit came out naming Cardinal Bernardine, and I had to call the Archdiocese and ask them what they thought. That I had a copy of it, was going to be published the next day, it was going to, you know, be sent. And they said, we're going to get back to you. And then hour or so later, my phone rang and it was Cardinal Bernardine. And all I could think was, oh boy, I'm really sorry. I feel like I'm going to be in a lot of trouble now. You know, I mean, I just thought, yikes. For the Cardinal to call me and he said, I have no idea what this guy's talking about. I mean, I'm paraphrasing, obviously, but denied it from the very beginning, told that same story onward. But I, of course, you know, I'm going to all Catholic schools as a grammar school, high school, college, you know. My kids have gone the same route. They all went to Marquette. You know, of course that shapes my view. I cannot sit here and say, oh, I am completely unbiased and I live in this tunnel. I do think at the same time, it has given me perspective of what this has meant to people in the pews. And for those who did not get it, you know, like, I mean, you'd certainly understand that abuse is awful, but they didn't really grasp this whole, like, oh my goodness, this is all a part of our lives, of our, you know, going to church on Sundays and our holidays and everything, and that the priest would come to dinner often for a holiday dinner or whatever, to have this story sort of land in my lap and look the other way would have also just really been complete hypocrisy. So yes, I do, you know, I say it with, you know, now I have conflicts. There's conflicts no matter what. I have a son who's in law enforcement. And so I try to stay away from those stories. You know, he's a federal agent. And right now, during all of this time, it's a difficult time. And so I try now to say, no, I can't really do that one today. You know, someone else should do that, because I would have, you know, my heart would be a part of that. I think that the church also raised me to be independent enough to, you know, I was a part of sort of, you know, a lot of bright nuns that said to us, go out there and grab it. You know, you don't have to just be whatever, you can be whatever you know, you imagine it, see it, go for it. And if I had cut that short, if I had said no, wouldn't that have also been just awful? I don't know. It's a challenge. It is a challenge to be fair every single day. And everyone brings their whole person with them, whether it's covering religion, whether it's covering City Hall, whether it's knocking on someone's door and asking them to tell your story. So you do have to sometimes remove yourself and sort of say, okay, I know that I think they're not telling me the truth, but I'm going to let that person say and let the viewer figure that out. But yes, I roundabout answer, but all of that is a part of me. Yes. Right.
And so it's also interesting to think that maybe your approach to it was more informed than someone who had not grown up in it when you were covering those stories.
Yes, I would say so. Yes. Before, and I meant to do this at the top tonight, and you had brought it up to me today, John Allen, and I don't know how many of you know John Allen, but John Allen, word came today that he had passed away, and he was the Vatican writer for many, many years. Wrote for the National Catholic Reporter, then wrote for the Crux. Mm. He wrote for the Boston Globe. I mean, he was just such a bright guy, and any time that I got to go to Rome, I would email him ahead of time and say, John, you have a minute. Will you talk to us? It would be like getting, you know, just the authority on what was going on in Rome. So it was just so bittersweet that today we were going to talk about religion and writing, and that John, when I saw that today, I went, wow, I don't cover religion as often every single day, but I just felt like I needed to say, you know, may John Allen rest in peace, because he was such a good man to me. And if you don't know him, look him up tonight, because he was quite bright and just really covered. He was the Vatican authority. Yeah.
Oh, well, thank you for sharing that with us as well. I thought at this point, maybe there might be some questions in the audience. If anybody has a question, I will come find you with the microphone.
Thank you. To your knowledge, Marianne, is this child abuse issue unique to the United States, or is it global, or do you have any perspective on that?
Yes. It is absolutely global. And I don't have all of the numbers, but in Ireland, they have dealt with it, in France, in Germany. Yes, it is absolutely global. Yes, yes.
Question about journalism school. Are there things that you learned in journalism school that no longer apply? And are there things that you learned in journalism school that should be applied now more than ever?
Good one. Well, you know, Medill was fabulous. And I was an English major, so I was not a journalism undergrad. So I really needed that practice of how to change my writing from essay writing to news stories. And their whole program at the time, it was much like a professional program. You took classes that were sort of law in Chicago, and you would go to 26th Street and cover a case and come back, and you had a deadline at 4 o'clock, and you wrote your little story that no one saw but your professor. And then we had ethics classes and that kind of thing. But one of my favorite, I loved this, that they taught us, you know, we represent the public's right to know. And that I was at the Oaklawn Village Hall, and they tried to shut down the hearing that we weren't allowed to be in there. And now I had my, you know, I was all ready, and I was like, we represent the public's right to know, you know, like, we, you know, we're here for this. And so I think, I'm sure that journalism school has completely changed of what's going on now, because it's instant. Everything is, no one's waiting for 5, 6, and 10. I mean, let's hope they are, please do. And that you can watch it forever online, but it's just so, so instant. You know, who has it first? Whether it's Twitter or Facebook or Insta and all that stuff. So that part, you know, is calm down, check your sources, make sure they're independent, more than one, you know, you need two people telling you the same thing, all that kind of stuff. But I think that more than ever, I mean, as journalists are facing a very tough time, we're not the only ones, like, we shouldn't all feel sorry for ourselves. We have really cool jobs, and they're awesome, and hang in there, and be tough, and ask the questions. But also, don't shy away, you know, like, don't give up and say, oh, well, this administration doesn't like us, so I guess we're just going to go along. Absolutely not. I tangled with Barack Obama, I mean, Senator Obama, when he was a senator, he wasn't all that nice to us. He was, you know, as he ran for president, he got to be a little bit nicer, but none of those. And as I said before, we are not to be their buddies, but he was quite prickly. So it isn't just the Republicans that aren't opening their doors to us. There's today, the Speaker of the House, Chris Welch, I think I'm not talking today. No, thank you. That happens a lot, almost every day. Yeah.
Marianne, the Cardinal here in Chicago and Pope Leo over in Rome, separately and together, are for you going to be the gift that keeps on giving.
You retire now.
You've got... you'll never have an empty pipeline. Here's a choice. What's either in your pipeline with respect to either of them separately or together, or what do you expect or wish you had in your pipeline?
I'd love the one-on-one with the Pope. Are you kidding? I'm working it very hard. So the Pope, obviously, his brother is here, and I've had lunch with the Pope's brother a couple times. trying to stay buddies, you know, or just stay in touch. Let me know what's going on. Tell me what's up. He's very careful. He brings his priest friend with, just in case he says anything, you know, that he's not supposed to say, you know. And, so that's pretty funny. Yeah, we had lunch just a couple months ago. And the priest buddy is, I don't have the brother's number. I thought I had it, and I don't. The poor guy had to put a ring doorknob. He didn't have any of that. He can't answer his phone. He gets letters all the time now. Please tell the Pope to pray for me. You know, please tell the Pope don't close my school. You know, all that kind of thing. So I got to go back in October. I mean, after, you know, going in May, and we stayed for 2 weeks. You know, we went thinking it was a 5-day trip. And then, of course, they picked the Pope from Chicago. So I'm like, whoa, we're here. We're going to get to stay. So we got to stay. And it was wild. Two of my kids are young adults. They're in their late 20s. They came over. They had planned. I had talked to my boss. I said, you know, they're going to pick the Pope in like 5 days. Do you mind? Can I? I'm already there. I mean, on my dime, I'll stay. And she, oh, you know, I said, I've never done that in all these years. She goes, okay. So my kids, I said, you get tickets. We'll figure it out. So they can't come over the day after the Pope is picked. And luckily, they actually bring us a little piece of equipment that we need. And we're walking over to the workspace to put it in the office. And my son and my daughter, they go, there's the Pope's brother. I said, what do you mean? Mom, he's been on TV a lot at home. I hadn't seen him yet because I'm in Rome, you know. I said, you sure? They're like, it's definitely the Pope's brother. So I go shimmying over to the Pope. It was crazy. We worked out of the Augustinian school. The Pope is Augustinian. You know, here's the St. Peter's, just right outside the pillars, right outside the big, you know, and you right here is the school. So the Pope's brother, John, came to drop off his stuff at the Augustinian school. So I walk over to him and I said, hey, I'm your aunt. He says, I know you. He said, you were at my school once. I said, oh, I hope it wasn't a bad story, you know. He said, no, it was okay. You were all right. You were all right. So, yeah, so that was pretty funny. But, yeah, if there is a way. So I got to go back when the kids from Our Lady of Mount Carmel on the north side went. And we really tried hard. You know, not only did they go, but there was a group of labor leaders that went. They had worked out this conference at all. I think they might have timed the two things together. I have no idea. But they were not as welcoming as the Our Lady of Mount Carmel kids. I said to them, I cannot go unless I'm going to be close to the Pope. They're just, I mean, how many times can they send me, you know? And so the Our Lady of Mount Carmel, such crazy begging, you know, that I did. I know someone that works there, da, 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 da. They said, we'll get you a ticket with the kids. So I was right there with the kids. So the Pope, but not my camera. So he, after the audience, he walks right up to them. You know, I hear you're from, you know, my brother told me you all were coming, you know, whatever. It was great. But I didn't get close enough to say, wait a minute, I have a question for you. You know, I wasn't really the place either. You know, they would have definitely like shooed me out of there. But if I could get that interview, and in fact, so I just spoke to Cardinal Supich recently. Was it about Archbishop Hicks? So now we have Ron Hicks going to New York. Let me tell you that story. And maybe it was that interview. Anyway, I said to him, all right, how am I getting this interview? You know, I need to. And so he gave me another name to work on. So we'll see. I'm hoping, you know, maybe a 1-year anniversary. Wouldn't that be nice? I don't think he's coming. Some are talking about maybe in the fall, you know, but also the fall is the election, the midterm. Would that be a problem? I don't know. He's going to go to some other places before he comes here. But if he comes here, oh my goodness, it would be beyond. Yeah. But Archbishop Hicks, just quickly, is anybody from the Juliet diet? Okay. So the crazy, of course I've interviewed him when he was here in Chicago. I like whatever. So everyone thought he was going to be the next Cardinal of Chicago. So anyway, so he gets this appointment. We got a tip like a couple of days before. Well, he, of course, not answering. No one's answering. The night before it was named, somebody from the Archdiocese, one of the Cardinals people texts me and says, if this happens, the Cardinal will be available at 10. You know, like, I mean, I should have like announced it, but I didn't, you know, but that's one of those things like, okay, I get it. You know, you're telling me, but not telling me. But anyway, Hicks was not going to talk to me. Then it was Christmas and everybody was away. He did do an interview or two. And I do think there have been some incidents. There have been a couple of priest abuse things out there that maybe that people felt that he could have done more about. I said to his guy, listen, you know, in the short 5-6 minutes, I'm going to have to ask him something, but that's not the focus of the interview. Not talking. No. He did one with, I think, Channel 9. He knows the anchorman at Channel 9. They went to high school together or something. And he might have done one with somebody else. Well, finally, last week, I called the Archdiocese here. I said, okay, what's up? Like, I mean, honestly, I think I've covered this story longer than he's been a priest. So why is he doing this? And they called for me. Next day, I got an interview with Archbishop Hicks. Oh, so, and this is, I interviewed him. I'm saving it for next week because he'll be installed on the 6th. Anyway, he starts the interview. Oh, I'm so glad. You know, I just wanted to tell you, and I already knew this part, but he said, my niece works with your daughter. I said, yeah. Oh, she thinks the world of her. And then, yeah, I know that. Yeah, thanks. And I'm thinking, so for 2 weeks now, you have not, you know, agreed, but finally, you know, and his interview was great. He was fine. He was, you know, absolutely. I kept thinking to myself, you're going to New York. I'm not quite sure why you're so nervous about me. I mean, you know, you're going to handle the questions fine. He did fine, but whatever, yeah.
Hi, I guess my question for you is, when you were a teacher, what was that final push for you to pursue your dream to be a journalist?
I did really like teaching. I mean, I had high school, and at Gordon Tech, I had all boys. At the time, it was the largest all boys school in the state of Illinois. It was 3,600 boys. It was crazy. There were so many boys in that. I mean, it was, and I had kids who were not good readers. I had taken a couple classes and how to teach reading to 9th and 10th grade. So they gave me all those guys. And they were not, you know, this wasn't special ed. They were just kids that didn't read well. So we were reading the driver's manual and we were reading stuff that they would want to read because we certainly were not reading, you know, Shakespeare at that age. And I always loved the new. I mean, my world, as the youngest of seven, we sat around the kitchen table and the world events were like, as I mentioned in that, you know, we debated what was going on. I grew up, I didn't see John Kennedy get shot. I was in about fourth grade, but I came home that day and I saw my older brothers and sisters all upset and we all watched the rest of it unfold, you know, and there were debates at our table about the Supreme Court justices and, you know, whether or not they should be the people that got in. And I mean, it was just all part of kind of our dinner table. So I just didn't have the guts at 21 or 22 to go say, I'm going to go do that. And while I liked teaching, I didn't want to have regrets. I didn't want life to pass me by and go, gee, you know, I like this, but I really want to do that. And I thought, you know, I don't want to turn 30 and say that was something I wanted to do and I didn't do it. And so it was, you know, it was a real gamble to go off and try it. But obviously, I don't regret it. Yeah. But no, I mean, teachers are all in my family and I love teach. Who knows, maybe I would teach again.
Well, on that note, can we all say thank you to Marianne for visiting?
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode from the American Writers Museum Podcast Network. Be sure to subscribe so you are notified when new episodes are released. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.